This is an interview taken for the Western Sydney Women's Oral History Project, From Farms to Freeways, Women's Memories of Western Sydney. This is an interview with Mrs. Brenda Nicol of Emu Plains, recorded on Tuesday, the 1st of October, 1991.
My name is Brenda Nicol, and my address is River Road, Emu Plains. Date of my birth is the 20th of the 4th, 1920. And the place of my birth was Ballarat, though I didn't live there. That was the home of my grandmother. I'm a widow now, and I suppose I'm a, dare I say it, these days, fourth or fifth generation. I have four children, four boys.
Okay, so to ask you a little bit about your family background, what did your father do and your mother? And what sort of work did your father do?
Well, my father was an Anzac, and he took up one of the soldier settlement blocks in the Riverina. My mother had been in Germany at the outbreak of war. She was an Australian and had gone over to England. She was very artistic, a painter, a writer, and a producer of plays, and even a writer of plays. I grew up, did I say I'd grown up in the Riverina?
No.
Yes, this was the Riverina.
Lovely.
But they were Victorians.
Mm-hmm. So when did you move to Penrith area, to Emu Plains?
Well, I'd come to Sydney with my sister. Actually, we stayed in the Girls Friendly Hostel that is still there opposite the University of Sydney. Mm-hmm. Yes. And then my mother died in 37. Suddenly she was coming up to stay with us from the Riverina, and she had a hemorrhage. I've forgotten.
A stroke, was
a
it?
A stroke, mm. Yes. I sort of faced up to it, but I was young. I was maybe about 17. And I think it hit me the following year, and my father decided to send me down here to the guest house. It was a guest house in these days.
This house?
Yes, this house was a guest house. It had a lot of other buildings around, and it was a very, very beautiful place with Emu Plains itself was a place of orange groves and peach trees and apricot trees, of grapevines and dairy farms. It was something of intense loveliness, really, with the hills behind, or the lower mountains behind, and the river. Of course, across the other side were just grazing lands, and again farms. It was just such a beautiful area. I came back again for another holiday, and then I decided one summer, we'd been camping, my sister and I and a young group, at Cat Eye Creek, which was a beautiful place then, without sewerage through it, as they're using it as a sewerage drain now. And I decided I wanted another holiday here and didn't have the necessary money, so I decided, like a lot of young people do today, that I'd come and work in the January holidays. Because working as a waitress for
the guest house.
Yes, for the three or four weeks I It was nothing like being a guest. And you saw then what a hard job it was. You saw behind the scenes that what a very hard life it was. I was only young then, but my husband, of course, was one of the family here, and we became interested in each other. I remember for my 20th birthday, he gave me the book Gone with the Wind and Northwest Passage, and at the time I preferred Northwest Passage for some reason or other. I think because the adventurous men that went north, their struggles and overcoming and the battle with the Indians and so forth, I preferred to Gone with the Wind.
And so this is where you met your husband?
Yeah, this is where I met, like lots and lots of others. And many people come back today because they had their honeymoon here and call in and see me. Yeah, a couple came back the other day. They'd been here as children in 1928, but that was just before the family had taken over this place. Mm-hmm. And actually the woman before was the first time it was used for a guest house, but there were a lot of division of rooms upstairs and extra rooms added on. So today it's not as the guest house. After my husband died in the early 60s, my sons and I started to peel back and demolish the bits and pieces that were added on.
When did you come to live here permanently? Well, when you were married, I suppose.
I was too young to be married, and he went off to the war in 1940 with his brother. There were three brothers, and one was killed in an accident. He was a school teacher, and he'd just gone down to Yanko in the February, and he was engaged to be married and was riding in to ring up his fiancée, and he was killed. The mother begged the two others not to join up for a while. It had to come because we could, for years, we could see the threatening of not only Hitler, but the fellow on the white horse, and all of the Cine Sound News, they'd have all this on, and Hitler had marched in and into Austria. There'd been the assassination of Dollfuss. That a few years before, that had a very big effect on me, I remember.
Yes.
People think that we didn't have those fears of those times, but I think all we young ones were in great fear of it. It had been, although we at the time didn't realise how close the Great War was behind us, just behind us, but we thought anything that's before you're born or before your memory, it may as well be 1,000 years before. Yes, so I can understand that a lot of people only go back to the 1950s now, as if the world started in 1950. But I know it was very, very hard for my mother-in-law to be. The two sons went off, and they were over in the Syria and Tobruk for the 9 months, and they didn't come back till 43, and they were to go on up to fight the Japanese. And I decided, Blood, you know, you probably won't get the chance. You know, you feel that the odds are against you, which is sounds a bit morbid, but we decided to get married then, like a lot of the returning men married. We'd said, oh, no war brides, because of the stories we'd heard of the tragedies of some of the marriages of the First World War, just marrying in haste. but we married in 43. I didn't come to live here until 45, after my first son was born. My husband was still away at the war then, going up into Borneo, and he felt that he must fight on while ever there was a prisoner of war there, because we'd heard so many of the dreadful tales, and I think it's had an effect on those people. It's still in your hearts today. It's something you can't throw off, even though you're not one of the prisoners of war. It's just a heartache that remains with you. But anyway, he felt that he had to go on with the others and until they were released. Well, he didn't come back then until my son was 10 months old, I think, before he saw him, like a lot of others. There were a lot of babies then born from the 9th Division, they say, when the 9th, after the 9th. Oh, well, they'd been back a couple of years by 45. Then life here was a bit hectic.
Did you run the guest house?
Well, my father and mother-in-law were running it all during the war, and they were very busy because there was a 30-mile limit on cars, or about 30 miles, and this was just within the limits of the petrol, and people would travel down. And people that went overseas normally would come here. And so they had to, because staff was very hard to get, you weren't allowed to employ women or men, well, women anyway, under 45. Able-bodied, I suppose it was the same for men, but able-bodied men, you realise the labour. What did they call that? You probably know from elsewhere. I've forgotten what they call the labour industry, which told you where you could work. People were called up for service. But
able-bodied people had to.
It had to be told where to go, yes. Under that, the staff could have children. Women could have children and work. So that they really had to limit the number they took, because the father ended up having to milk the cows. You see, there were a lot of cattle on the property for the cream on the table, and the horses.
How much land did the house occupy, or the property?
Well, it was over 10 acres, which... It is small in comparison to the outback properties, but for here it was quite a handsome lot of land around. Other properties were larger that had the orchards, but 10 acres was quite enough with a guest house, and they had some crops for them, animals, and...
Did they grow vegetables too?
No, not really. They had oranges and fowls, but even then they had to buy fowls because they always had chicken on the Sunday dinner. Anyway. They bought fowls from the locals and plucked them, and which you wouldn't do these days. The awful plucking and.
So you were right on the river. It must have been. A lovely spot for a guest house.
Well, it was a wonderful spot for a guest house, yes. They had about 4 rowing boats with a little wharf down there on the edge of the water, and a raft which they towed in every night, because you saw the rowers there, and they often used to practice at night. So they always pull that raft in to the shore at night so that the rowers wouldn't hit the raft. But it was a wonderful thing out in the middle of the river. Mind you, I wouldn't swim in it now, but the water was pumped up, so it was our drinking water. And it was lovely water then. And it was also Penrith drinking water, so that they monitored the state of the water always, because Katoomba had sewerage running down even in those days, and also Goulburn, apparently, because I remember quite a funny story in 49 where a bullock was seen floating on the river here, and this was all under the Blue Mountains Council then, and someone from the family rang up the Blue Mountains Council health inspector to say that there was a bullock floating on the river and the water supply would be affected. So someone, they sent somebody down, and they, it had, the wind had come and blown the bullock over to the other side. So they said, oh no, it's not our business, it's over the Penrith side. So they rang the Penrith Council, and the wind had blown it back, and they said, no, that's Blue Mountains business, it's on the Blue Mountains side. So they had to ring back again, and it kept blowing back and forth until it reached a ridiculous state. And they said, well, something's got to be done. You know, we don't care who does it, as long as it's gone. But I don't know who to, probably Penrith, because it was their water supply after all.
Yeah. Yes.
So they pumped in, there was a holding tank down near Log Cabin, it's still there. I suppose it'll go soon, the tank. I don't think it's used for anything, but we all had pumps to the river, of course, and with all the floods, flood warnings, originally they had an old pump that took a lot of patience if it, anything went wrong with it. When my husband was here, he was most patient with engines, and he would sit for a long time and get the thing going again. But during the war, his father didn't have that sort of time. He had to be everything anyway. Mm. And he bought an electric motor. And of course, you had to run down and seize the electric motor every time there was a warning of a flood. Mm. And sometimes you were caught, and had to send it into the Penrith. They had their big electricity depot there then, and they would put it in their hot ovens and dry it out slowly so you could use it again.
Penrith had electricity very early on, didn't it? So, but not so much gas, that the people in Penrith don't
seem to. Well, probably somebody else can tell you when electricity came.
Yeah, it was about 1890.
Yes, you know, I have heard of that, but unless I see it written down in front of me, I don't remember. Yeah. But I do know that in the guest house days, at 11 o'clock the lights were switched off, and anybody coming from the pictures, if they'd gone into Penrith, the guests, had candles, and they had to light their candles and go upstairs. It always amused me, but that's the way it was, whether it was just too expensive.
And do you have electrical appliances here?
Yes, they had a lovely big enamel fridge. I wished I'd kept it in a way, not that it had ran on a motor, you know, big thing. You had to have a cupboard and an outlet to the air for this motor to run. But it was so beautifully enamelled, it wouldn't, I mean, a new fridge can easily go rusty these days. It's a bit of thin coating of paint or something, but these were baked enamel, wonderful big
thing. An old thing. Silent night or something.
No. It was a Westinghouse. Yes. Yeah. A silly little joke about the rabbit makes you remember what the name of them.
What's the
silly little Westinghouse? Yeah, the West. Yeah. Don't you know that silly little one? A rabbit was sitting in the fridge. I don't know why the rabbit, but there were rabbit jokes then. And they said, "What are you doing in there?" "I'm Westing." Yeah. Ridiculous. I called it shaggy dog jokes, or, you know, why is a piece of string, or because the trams run up George Street. They were the silly jokes during the
war. And did you have the sewer on here?
Yes, they did. When they first came in the 30s, they often laugh about the boxes they had behind that shed, that old stone shed. And they had to go there. And one of the guests said to my father-in-law, this is second-hand, of course, that he loved being here, but he wouldn't come back until they had septic sewerage on. So they got septic sewerage, big. They were on the blocks that were sold next door, the block that was sold, big septic sewerage there. So,
and did you have indoor facilities, bathroom and toilet facilities for the guests?
Oh, yes. They had a bathroom and bathrooms and showers outside. I've knocked them down, some of them. One of the buildings where the laundry is, you may have noticed. Was a shower room there, and the toilets were there were two toilets there, and there was a connecting walkway, which is not there now. I could have it put up again, but I haven't. I just got old.
And so you didn't have your children until the late 40s.
Well, I had the first one in 45 and the second one in 47, and it was becoming very difficult. It was very difficult for young people starting up marriage then, because the building materials were very restricted. My sister-in-law and my husband's brother and my sister-in-law decided they'd have a little room upstairs and a second little room coming out onto the balcony. But we had a choice. The parents gave us a choice. But mind you, with guests all around, bringing up a little baby, I decided I'd go for the what they call the bachelor's quarters and the staff quarters over there, because I thought I'd be a little further away from the guests, and I didn't want babies disturbing them. It was a good little baby, luckily for me, but he still woke at 5, and I'd get up and take him for a walk down along the river or somewhere in the first year, so that the guests wouldn't be disturbed. But everywhere it was difficult. Young couples had to live with their parents, lots of the parents, or take turns. My sister-in-law's father was a master builder, and they built halfway down the paddock. The building's still there, but now it's enclosed with other houses. And the father had a heart attack and died within 3 months of the son's returning, so it was a bit hectic. Then they had to sort of do his... Well, he do the cooking, he was the chef, but he was hoping, he said, you must always learn to cook so that if you have anyone to do the cooking, they'll never hold it over you, that you'll be left in the lurch if they suddenly decide to take off. You must be able to cook. So they all they'd sort of seen how to run that part of it, otherwise it would have been a great deal more difficult. The younger brother did the cooking for a while, and then the mother, her mother was here, and she was in her 80s, and she died, and she was just here on a holiday. So it was a difficult time for my mother-in-law, and then she got cancer and died in 1950. And then the other brother decided the life was just too hard with the family. He'd had a son. He'd had a daughter too, a couple of months older than my first son. And with two children, he felt it was too much. So he sold his portion to my husband. And we battled on, and I had a third child then in 51 years. And it got harder and harder. It wasn't something I looked forward to. I mean, some people love that sort of business, and I think the mother quite enjoyed it, although the father wanted to retire. But I didn't, but I still married my husband.
So you really both ran the guest house then, did you?
Yes, and time had become very awkward. I think in 49 they brought in the 40-hour week and good luck to people. Mm. But it meant that you had to put on extra staff. Mm. And the employment situation was that we were very, very short of people for all the jobs then. And so people didn't want to do domestic work, you know, cleaning and waitressing. And I didn't blame them. But it meant that any help that you got was not the best. You see, the wages were set so that you paid the highest wages, as high as the Hotel Australia had to pay there,
mm-hmm.
and you had inferior staff.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I had the third baby, I remember I was breastfeeding, and I'd be up till 1 o'clock and then up again at 5, which was a bit of a hopeless situation,
mm-hmm.
because the staff had let you down. You know, some of them would go up and tipple too much or something like that. It was a real headache. We'd have the GPS. Newington would stay here, and we had grammar, and we'd have the interstate teams. The King's Cup stay here. Well, I can remember that year. Suddenly, the overseas beef sales went up about 52, I think it was, and it was so expensive, this steak that you had to provide, that you ended up just sort of working to pay staff, and they had blackouts, and the wooden stove, we'd had an electric stove, I think McFarlane had it put in during the war to cut down on every job, like having wood cut and that sort of thing, for the big stove. He put in this electric stove, and of course there were we had the 49 blackouts. You remember the strikes, the big mining strikes of the 49. Well, it meant that we had a lot of blackouts then, which was a strain on guest houses. By 52, we decided it was getting too difficult with the staff situation. The only guest house, I think, was probably one out of Malaysia that had a family, and that's now Hopewood, that carried on beyond the time. The others were going out left, right and centre. And mainly, too, because motels were coming in. And people wanted the wall-to-wall carpets.
Mm.
And whereas there might have been comfort in rooms like this as sitting rooms and the dance hall, the rooms were covered with lino and just scatter rugs, bedrooms. Well, people suddenly wanted something like glass and chrome and wall-to-wall carpets and the comfort of motels. It switched back now. If this area had been still the rural area that it was.
There's no other housing around here.
Well, the nearest house was down across Nepean Street, which was about, what would it be, a quarter of a mile? And it was a poultry farm and orange orchard and apricot orchard. There was one up here, a little closer. I think it's about 15 houses away now, to get a sort of picture. A pretty weatherboard one it was, with the late Victorian, but that was demolished for a house. That had, I think, about 15 acres around it. And there were 3 acres in between our place, but which belonged to this acreage when it was first... until about 1907, when it was the owner, original owner, had died, and one of the family kept 3 acres and sold the main part.
And what about but along the river? Did you have any neighbours that way?
Well, that was our nearest neighbour along the river that way. Mm-hmm. The next neighbour was about half a mile over in the middle of the paddock, mm-hmm. middle of the orchards and grape vines. And then there was no other house all the way up to the mountain,
really?
Along River Road. Buring's was back further, the wine man,
mm-hmm.
yes. I don't know if Audrey mentioned the Buring's.
Yeah.
Well, of Buring's wine. His place is still there. It was about a 1920s place.
Mm.
And he had a lovely little zoo there as well, with kangaroos and emus and peacocks. And the guests